Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios here in Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Joining me, as usual, is Jeremy Goldcorn, a.k.a. Jin Yumi, the man behind the much-beloved Danwei.com. Say hello, Jeremy.
Good evening, Kaiser.
And good to see that you still have all of your fingers. I assume that you spent many an hour out in Miyun at your in-laws place blowing shit up.
That is correct, and I do have all my fingers.
Very good. Also with us today is Mary Kay Magistad, correspondent for Public Radio International here in Beijing. Great to have you back again, Mary Kay.
Good to be back.
And how did you spend your holiday?
I was on the island of Palawan watching the waves roll in and talking to the head of the Western Command in the Philippines about apprehending Chinese fishing boats that were in what he considered Philippine waters.
Oh, wow. So it was both balmy, relaxing, or
yeah,
balmy,
great
relaxing,
when that
and,
happens.
And really sort of productive for work. Yeah. Nice. And I understand that that's your MO. You always sort of manage to get this sort of tropical assignment during
the coldest
of the year.
It's funny how that happens.
I hope your producers are listening here. And last, we are joined by Gadi Epstein. Oh, actually, not quite last. We have a little last-minute addition. So Gadi Epstein, a regular on Seneca, formerly with Forbes and now correspondent for The Economist here in Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
And how was your Chunjie holiday, Gadi?
Well, it was busy. We were putting out the first China section. We have a new China section in The Economist.
Right, so. And that's something we're going to talk to. First, let me quickly dispense with this one minor character here. Evan Osnos is also with us here, and you'll know why in a couple of weeks, or hopefully, I don't know, maybe like a month or two out. But he's going to remain silent for most of this. We're going to drag him in to recommend at the end, and also to talk about our third topic today. So today, first, we're going to talk about the recent nastiness and vituperation between residents of Hong Kong and people from the Chinese mainland. Alleged discrimination against Hong Kongers by Dolce and Gabbana, the results of a poll that was taken by the Hong Kong University, or University of Hong Kong. What is it?
The public opinion program at the University of Hong Kong.
Okay, thank you, Jeremy.
Two academics who did the survey were Mr. Robert Chang and Dixon Singh.
I know so many Dixons from Hong Kong. It's like the most popular male name, like counterpart to Queenie. Anyway, we'll have plenty of time to talk about Hong Kongers and their strange names in just a bit. It says Kaiser.
Very ordinary name, that.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, there was that spat with the MTR with the 10-year-old eating dried noodles and some name-calling by a certain hyper-nationalistic dick of a Peking University professor. And now a full-page anti-mainlander ad in a Hong Kong paper. So things are at a real boil right now, and we're going to talk about the roots of all that tension. Then we're going to talk about the role China has played in the U.S. presidential race in the contest both for the GOP nomination as well as in President Obama's State of the Union that he gave on January 24th. But first, since we've got Gadi here, let's hear about this new Economist dedicated weekly China section. I understand that this is the first time that the newspaper, as your magazine styles itself,
right,
has added a country-specific section since, what, 1942?
Since basically about a month after Pearl Harbor.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
right. So 70 years ago to the month, we started, The Economist started its America survey, where we were devoting special attention in the newspaper to the United States. And since then, they haven't added a new country section. They have Asia and they have Europe, et cetera, and the UK, of course. But this is the first time they've added a country since then, and just kind of reflects, obviously, China's huge importance in the world.
And that's the official editorial line, huge importance. It wasn't a Pearl Harbor-ish event that precipitated.
There's no equivalent Pearl Harbor precipitation that I know of.
So what are we expecting from the new China section besides sort of the arch and condescending editorializing that we've come to know and love?
Well, we are going to expand on our ability to be arch and condescending.
Ah, very good.
And to that extent, we've expanded staff to research the ability to be patronizing and self-important. We're also going to, coincidentally with that, have more coverage of China.
Like, okay, because, I can't remember the last time I picked up The Economist and there weren't at least a couple of China stories. So, are we talking like 3 pages now or?
It'll be – so last week was the kickoff and we had actually 7 pages
right,
on China.
Right, that was impressive.
Six of, kind of news copy or feature copy and one lead editorial. Most of the weeks it'll be 2 pages of news or feature copy. plus, you know, every once in a while editorials.
So who's here on the ground now for The Economist? It's you and James Miles.
So James Miles and me, and also, you know, Ted Plafker's in Beijing.
Oh, right, Ted.
He'll be contributing quite a lot. We'll have hopefully soon a Shanghai bureau. We have several people in Hong Kong, one of whom we hope to get into Shanghai soon for business reporting. The people in Hong Kong focus more on business and finance, but they'll often, or at least sometimes, contribute to our China section. So.
And if I may make an appreciative observation, not only do Gotti, Ted, and James have years of experience covering China, but also the China editor in London, Rob Gifford, foreign editor, the Asia editor, Dominic Ziegler, a former China correspondent. So they've got quite a power team.
That's right.
Terrific stuff. Rob is has been hired to be the China editor in London.
Right.
And
China Road was his latest book.
That's right.
He, of course, NPR correspondent here.
Right, in both Beijing and Shanghai.
And, China,
and in between London. So, it's great. It's very exciting. And we'll have more coverage of, I mean, to give you a more serious answer, the intent is to provide more like kind of a breadth of coverage about China in depth as well, more regional coverage. I was in Yunnan a couple weeks ago for two of the stories last week, you know, one about tobacco, one about coffee. More ability to get into issues that would have just slipped between the cracks under our old system. I think that will be reflected every week, that we'll have stories that you wouldn't have seen before. And I think it'll be great.
You're going to be filing maniacally now. I mean, you're on a weekly, very punishing publishing schedule now, right?
Obviously. I shouldn't even be here.
Right. I'm wondering why you are here. And I think most of our listeners are really wondering what is going to happen. Well, first of all, are your new bosses okay with your very high-profile social media presence?
You know, the official word is social media is fine.
Okay.
A few Economist people on Twitter. I mean, The Economist itself has a, you know, Twitter account and Facebook account. And there are people who will tweet their stories sometimes. It's not nearly as aggressive as, you know, other news organizations are about it. And we'll see how it develops over time. I mean, we have but we're increasing our web presence. We're going to have a China blog that goes with the print edition.
Which leads me to my next question. What is the name of the new China blog?
We don't have one yet. We've solicited people to come in, you know, nominate their own suggestions for the China blog.
Most of them were pretty appalling.
Really? What have you heard so far?
Well, they were kind of like dragon and silk and.
Please have dragon, panda, bicycles, and inscrutable, or some combination.
The inscrutable pearl of the Oriental dragon. Panda.
Sorry, too late. I've already taken that.
Yeah. So I think the inscrutable panda is not a bad choice.
The China slant, the Middle Kingdom, Chinese eyes.
You sent me a few of those offline, Kaiser, and I was going to protect your reputation by not repeating them. But we have a few amusing selections from people. One that I like that we won't use because it. I mean, we'll have an English name to the blog. But you know, one of our Asia blog right now is called Banyan. Right after the tree,
sure.
And someone suggested Banfa.
Banfa for those of you, those few of you who haven't already subscribed to Pop Up Chinese and learned Mandarin to this point. Banfa means sort of
a way of doing something.
A way of doing something.
Right. Like, so it's actually a very clever title, but yeah. I don't think it'll win the day. But I liked
well,
it.
Well, my vote is with Banfa. And what happens to fake Tom Friedman? I think we also want to know this.
And fake Xinhua correspondent, my favorite.
Don't forget, you know, fake White House reporter, a fake China expert, some of my various Twitter names over the years. They've already, you know, receded a little bit. I don't use them as often, but I'll bring them out every once in a while when there's I was working, unfortunately, during the State of the Union. I think the State of the Union was happening right as I was on, you know, production deadline.
They scheduled it at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. The State of the Union is a prime opportunity for commentators
snarkiness.
Like fake White House reporter
exactly.
To weigh in on their thoughts about how this relates to China or fake China expert. But I missed that opportunity this time. But, you know, Xi Jinping is going to be in the U.S. soon. Maybe we'll see somebody pop up at that point.
Okay, great. Let's jump into our first topic. So the escalating ugliness over mainlanders in Hong Kong. Why don't we start off reviewing for our listeners the basic sequence of events, starting with the more proximate causes of the recent flare-up in tensions. Mary Kay, do you want to have a go at this one? how did this start? I mean, there's obviously a deeper context to it, but should we start with the poll? Why don't we talk about the poll first?
God, it's been building up for so long. I mean, when I lived in Hong Kong in the mid-90s, there was a lot of resentment of mainland Chinese, but then it was a qualitatively different kind of resentment. Hong Kongers tended to look down on mainlanders. They thought they were sort of uncouth and they weren't up to the same economic level. Since the handover, there were a few years where there seemed to be a new enthusiasm for learning Mandarin and for kind of embracing the new identity until the Chinese government started to talk about having new legislation that would curtail Hong Kong civil rights. And then there were big demonstrations and people seemed to kind of wake up to the fact that they do have a separate identity and it matters to them. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to now.
Which I have a little timeline I could quickly go over.
Yeah, sure, Jeremy.
Put this month in context. So January the 12th was when I think the news broke that there was the survey we mentioned, Hong Kong University's Mr. Chung and Mr. Singh did a survey about Hong Kong identity. And
this isn't the first, though. They've
been doing it
after year,
every
right?
for 15 years. But this year, or at least it was December when the survey was done, Hong Kongers' identity as, you know, did they feel themselves to be Chinese or not, that score fell to a 12-year low.
Primary identity.
Right. Well, are you primarily Chinese or are you Hong Kong? So
Asian
now
was there
more
too.
Hong Kong people are thinking, I'm Asian, I'm Hong Kong, but not specifically Chinese. And then this was reacted to by editorials in two of the big pro-Beijing newspapers in Hong Kong, the Wenweibo and Dagongbao, which called Mr. Chung a political fraudster with evil intentions to incite Hong Kong.
A slave of black political funding was my favorite phrase.
Right.
And this kind of neo-cultural revolution language has been coming up quite a lot in the last few weeks in Hong Kong, where there's been a specific target that has been set by pro-mainland China media. And then they go after them with this language, where it's like, where
is
it?
But the Hong Kongers, really productive, right? The Hong Kongers have, of course, been fighting back. Mid-January, there was a demonstration outside the Dolce & Gabbana store in Hong Kong because D&G was not allowing Hong Kong locals to take photos of the store for whatever reason. But they were allowing mainlanders because mainlanders spend more money at the store. So there was a demonstration that was arranged on the internet and covered heavily on the internet, which exacerbated these mainland versus Hong Kong tensions. Soon after that, about a week later, January the 20th, the video hit YouTube of the mainland child with his mother eating a snack of
dried instant noodles.
On the subway on the MTR in Hong Kong and being admonished by a Hong Konger who spoke very heavily accented bad Mandarin. And this went viral on the internet. In Hong Kong, people were looking at the video and saying, look at these disgusting mainlanders with no manners eating on our subway. And it was responded to on an online kind of talk show by Peking University professor and nationalist Kong Qingdong, who claims to be a descendant of Confucius.
That's pretty well established. He's the 73rd lineal descendant.
Whatever.
Which makes it all the more shameful. But
he called many Hong Kongers are dogs. They're victims of colonial.
They're not human. They're dogs.
They're dogs. Very soon after that, there was a protest. January the 29th, there was a protest in Hong Kong against mainland mothers going to Hong Kong to have babies. And then I'm not sure if it was January the 30th or February the 1st, a group of Hong Kongers organized on the internet took out a huge,
in the
Apple Daily, which is the most popular. Is it the most popular newspaper in Hong Kong? If not,
it's
one of them.
It's a very popular newspaper.
Your daily circulation, I think it's like 80,000 or something is the daily circulation.
And they took out a full-page ad basically calling mainland Chinese people coming to Hong Kong locusts.
Right.
With illustration. Yeah. And then the latest installment I saw today, February the 2nd, it may have been around since yesterday, somebody in Hong Kong made a video.
No. This has been around. 11 months ago.
Yeah.
Oh, that's been around, that video.
Yeah.
That has been around.
So this locust theme has been around. It's a cartoon, right, with a song, and right?
Is that right. It's a very famous Cantonese pop song that they've rewritten lyrics to that are, I mean, for me at least personally, my sympathies were clearly sort of with the Hong Kong, until I saw this thing, the ad, and I mean, it evaporated instantly. I mean, this was just so beyond the pale. It was just absolutely absurd. And we'll talk about that in a little more detail now that we have the rough outlines of what happened. Now, let's look at what the spectrum of reaction to this issue here in China has been as it's registered online. I'm sure this is something, Gotti, you've been following. Jeremy always follows this stuff, maybe.
Well, the thing that I followed the most, the closest, is the reaction to Professor Kong Qingdong's statements that, you know, most Hong Kongers are dogs and stuff like that. And certainly amongst the sort of more liberal elements of the commentariat or the digerati on sites like Weibo, there's been a lot of criticism and mocking of Kong Qingdong as being basically an uncivilized barbarian and, you know, very provincial with bad manners and a filthy mouth.
We've known this about the man for a long time. This is the same guy, don't forget, who said of the Southern Group and liberal reporters in China something along the lines of, if they were all lined up against a wall and shot, my heart wouldn't ache for a single one of them, right? So,
right. He likes to say, yeah. And, you know, he likes to say outrageous things. There has also been some support for him. I mean, I think quite a lot of mainland Chinese feel that, you know, Hong Kongers do look down on them. And this may be experience that's gained inside China working in a company where there's a Hong Kong manager who treats mainland Chinese people terribly and is always extremely obsequiously polite to foreigners. I think some people have experienced that in China. And also, you know, in Hong Kong itself, you know, Mandarin-speaking Chinese often are treated with less than respect.
Yeah, so he's not an outlier completely. I mean, he maybe have been extremely rude, but he was expressing a sentiment that a lot of people certainly feel, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's brought a regional resentment to the forefront that's been out there for a while. It's changing in its character because, of course, mainland Chinese now have, you know, a lot of money and they're a completely different profile. Socially than they were, you know, 15, 20 years ago. So there's also resentment of the fact that they've perhaps surpassed them financially.
The shoe is on the other foot. How does it feel? Right.
But yeah, with Kong's comments are, you know, they're essentially hate speech.
Sure.
And I mean, how far the apple falls from the tree 73 generations later, I guess, from Confucius. But I think it brings out – it's good that it brings out this these resentments into the open. I mean, I think this is obviously something that needs to be kind of – there needs to be discussion about.
And go ahead.
One of the things that came out in the videos was the guy who spoke up on the subway and said, you know, hey, there's a sign that says no eating, no drinking, your kids spilling stuff all over the floor. And then he heard other mainlanders making fun of his Mandarin. And he said then in Cantonese, we're in Hong Kong, we should be speaking Cantonese, you should be speaking Cantonese to me. Well, one thing that Kong said was, you're in China, you should be speaking Mandarin. Everyone should be speaking Mandarin. Those of us who speak Mandarin don't need to learn dialects. What you are speaking is a dialect. So it also comes down to this identity question again, and it's also built on top of something that's been happening politically, which is that in by-elections in December, there was seen to be a lot of interference. The chief executive, the head of Hong Kong, the election for the new one is coming up next month. And increasingly, a larger and larger number of Hong Kong residents are getting kind of impatient. You know, they were promised a higher level of democracy by this point. And what the mainland has been telling them is, and Kong said this as well, we expected that you would come back to China with your hearts as well, and you haven't done it sufficiently. So basically, you haven't earned democracy.
Right. Basically, for context, Hong Kong doesn't have completely free elections that are untouched by the heavy hand of Beijing. Their choice for chief executive ends up running Hong Kong. And
person ends up being anointed rather than elected.
Right.
But at popular level, I mean, the issues have still focused around the mainland Chinese mothers coming to Hong Kong and taking up room in hospital beds. I mean, this is what was on that poster, on that full-page ad. You know, would you like to see Hong Kong spend 1 million Hong Kong dollars every 18 minutes on the children of non-Hong Kongers, Hong Kongers have had enough. I mean, that was the spirit of this.
Right, both because health care is cheap and good in Hong Kong, and also because some of the mainland mothers are hoping that the kids would then have some rights of residency in Hong Kong. And this has been an issue for 15 years.
I mean,
it's become a more acute issue
right,
in the last few months.
Right, but it sounds like, you know, California or Arizona or you know, these others, or what, Alabama recently with their really ridiculous immigration laws.
Or it even sounds like the kind of thing you'll hear on dinner tables in Beijing and Shanghai about people from other provinces coming
here.
Sure,
yeah. I mean, which is exactly what my wife's first reaction to this was, and I'll always defer to her. I mean, she was basically, you know, I mean, her immediate reaction was like, well, you know, people in first-tier cities treat Wai Di and, you know, people from the provinces exactly like this in exactly the same way. I'm sure that she hasn't seen this full page advertisement.
Yeah, there's a big difference in self identity here. I mean, the people who come from the countryside or from other regions still identify themselves as Chinese.
Right.
There's a huge gulf here between the attitudes of Hong Kongers and mainlanders.
And I mean, this is, I think, one of the fascinating questions facing China at the moment is, what does it mean to be Chinese? You know, if you're a Hong Konger, you're used to lining up for the bus. If you live in Beijing, you're not used to lining up for the bus. Are you both Chinese? Is lining up for the bus indicative of being Chinese? And the Hong Kongers are forced to ask themselves this on a very basic level. We're in the subway, and these people from the mainland are letting their kids eat in a way that we wouldn't, you know. But, I mean, those are the kinds of small things that make people, I mean, they're prejudice against different races or ethnic groups.
And what
has always been based
on this. Taiwanese making of all this, watching this, you know, this one country, two systems at work?
I don't actually know what the reaction in Taiwan has been. Has anyone seen any reacts from Taiwan? Yeah.
But two things are interesting to me about this, both that Hong Kong, a lot of Hong Kong people look at this and look at it as a question of civility, of how you act in a public space. But also the Chinese reaction, at least from people like Kong, doesn't really engage with the issue. Should the mother have, you know, instead of insulting the guy who was talking to her, said, oh, okay, I didn't realize, put the food away, and you know.
She did say that, right?
She did.
She didn't put the food away.
Well, but she said, we didn't know that this was the rule, right?
We didn't know, but like basically go away and insulted him. And right. So it started thing. So instead of engaging with what actually happened, it becomes this big issue of we, China, we're powerful, you should be doing things our way. And, you know, where do you get off, you know, even raising a point like that on a subway? You should have done it differently.
Did seeing that full page advertisement change anyone's sympathies? I mean, it certainly did for me. I mean, to me, that and coupled with the double whammy of watching that video and looking at the statistics on the video, which were just appalling to me, the video had been viewed 750,000 times with 14,342 likes to only 560 dislikes, which means it's being seen, you know, almost exclusively by people in Hong Kong. Of course, it's on YouTube blocked. It wasn't on Tudou or Youku or any of the Chinese internet video sites.
Well, I think my attention goes towards the root cause in both for resentment on both sides.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, these people are coming down, mainlanders are coming down to Hong Kong for reasons of lack of effective government and services in the mainland, but not being able to provide safe, baby formula, proper health care, you know, for, you know, pregnant mothers. There are reasons why people are rushing into Hong Kong. And there's a reason why Hong Kongers are resentful, because they're like, they built this, they feel that the ownership of this, you know, even though maybe they didn't quite
it. Where's the sense of, you know, there but for the grace of God go I? I mean, why can't they just see that if they had been
the
born
obligation
200
is not
kilometers north of where they were born, I mean.
But the obligation isn't entirely on them to have that attitude. The obligation is also on the government in the mainland to do better by its citizens as well. And some of the spotlight should be shown on that.
Sure,
I think.
Some of it. But, I mean, when there's this – I don't even know what to call it. I mean, it's certainly not – it's not like sort of – you know, let's call it an ethnic difference. I mean, because it has functionally become an ethnic difference, right? I mean,
it's just cultural, because across the border in Guangdong, where they're also Cantonese, it's
cultural
different.
Okay, fine.
Obviously, the humanist response should be to have empathy for, you know, for your fellow – man, period, regardless of.
But when
you know,
you're a small place and it's a question of identity, and you see yourself being flooded by people who have a different identity, a different way of doing things, and you don't like it, and you were promised 50 years of separation, we're, you know, separate but, you know, still part of the main whole, and it's not happening quite that way. You know, you could see why people would be resentful. I do agree that the video was extreme, and, you know, it's not going to be doing anyone any good.
Yeah, I found it every bit as, if not more offensive than what Kong Qingdong said.
Yeah.
Jeremy, any final thoughts on how this might sort itself out? I mean, do you see this? What's the solution here? I mean, where does this go?
I think this is going to be a source of ongoing tension over the next year and the years to come. I mean, why wouldn't it be? It's no different from Arizona being next to Mexico.
The astonishing thing, I mean, we're going to see in the next couple of days the mainland Chinese reaction to the full page ad in the Apple Daily. We're going to see the reaction to that video, which I promise you is going to make its way onto the Chinese video sites in that probably if it hasn't already, because it really only came back to the attention of people today.
Right.
This being Thursday, February 2nd.
And just to zoom out to big picture, don't forget the Chinese government hasn't given up on the anti-sedition law in Hong Kong. They've just put it to one side for the moment. So they could point to something like this as a reason why they need to stop hate speech.
It will be interesting to see how political forces in both countries respond to what's going on now in terms of whether it'll bring out more conservative elements on both sides.
In both entities.
Yeah.
This is going to be a hell of a story. I mean, it's going to have some – I mean, it's going to play out over the next few months, if not years.
But I think it is also a central question of Chinese identity, because, I mean, today when we say China, most people take that to mean the People's Republic of China. But American Chinese don't usually identify very closely with mainland Chinese people. Taiwanese people are different. Hong Kongers are different. Chinese in Singapore and Malaysia are different. Chinese in Cuba are different. And the question of what it means to be Chinese in the 21st century is something that we're only just starting to explore. And the government of the PRC is generally not very keen to see that question explored. But there's nothing they can do about it now.
Well, I think the PRC government sees one answer to that question. Those people are all Chinese.
Yes. They're all Chinese and they should listen to us.
Right.
But not all of those people are going to be happy in that way of structuring things.
No, they won't.
Okay, let's pull that one to a close for now and move on to our next topic, which is how China has figured into electoral politics in the U.S., specifically into the presidential race. And for this discussion, let's bring in Evan Osnos from The New Yorker.
Greetings.
Hey, how are you, Evan?
Doing okay.
Yeah. We've seen it come up quite a bit in the GOP debates. We had erstwhile GOP candidate John Huntsman, who was, of course, the ambassador to China appointed by President Obama. He took a lot of heat for remarks that he made in what I think people assumed was Mandarin during one debate before he dropped out. We've seen this whole debate over offshoring of jobs. Is there anything, first of all, markedly different than 4 years ago or 8 years ago? I mean, China has figured in every race since 92, right? I mean, at least. I mean, in the race between Bush 41 and Bill Clinton at the Democratic Convention, I think it was during his speech, Bill Clinton said, accused Bush of having coddled dictators from Baghdad to Beijing, right? That was his famous line. But we're all familiar with the pattern of how things go. There's a lot of rhetoric. There's a lot of heat. And then once somebody's settled into the Oval Office, everything calms right down. So is there anything different, Gotti?
Yes, I do think there's one big difference, which is this will be the first presidential election in that time frame where the American economy is just doing terribly. I mean, the 92, they were coming out of the recession, but China wasn't to blame. Its economy was also in doldrums.
Of course not.
Post Tiananmen. This time, we've had a booming decade for China, and they did not suffer from the financial crisis, yet, like the U.S. did. And so it's easy to scapegoat China for lost jobs, for high unemployment, and a slow growing economy in a way that wasn't an issue in the past. And I think the reason that China actually, I don't think, was ever a huge election issue in any of those previous presidential elections is that it was still abstract. As in the 90s, it was a human rights issue, but that was never one of the top two or three things that you would decide a president on.
Now it's all about jobs.
Right. But now it hits them where they care.
If you look at 92, this is Evan talking. If you look at 92, China was invoked essentially as a kind of moral issue. I mean, this was when it was the butchers of Beijing. That was the line that was used in the campaign. And the difference now is that it's China invoked as rival, as threat, as potentially the thing that makes us feel insecure about ourselves. And so, I mean, that taps into a very different reservoir of emotion in the voters. But I think one of the things that was surprising was that over the course of Huntsman's campaign, it went from being this great asset that he ostensibly had all this foreign policy experience to by the end where the notion that he was speaking Mandarin occasionally, he would sort of, throw in a word or two. That was regarded as vaguely seditious.
And that he has an adopted Chinese daughter.
Yeah. I mean, it got really to the point
To be fair, that was just one Ron Paul wacko supporter who put up a video the Manchurian candidate video.
And it's almost inevitable. I mean, if you go back, John McCain ran into the same thing because he had a daughter who was adopted from South Asia. I mean, but in John Huntsman's case, I mean, there were people who said by the end that he had demonstrated that he had a tin ear for the Republican constituency because speaking Mandarin right now was about as bad idea as you can get. But I mean, I think what you saw when you got to the State of the Union was that in some sense, President Obama had to respond to what has been sort of coming out over the course of the campaign, which is this stronger and stronger China message.
Before we get too deeply into the State of the Union, let's focus back on the GOP field, well, what's left of the GOP field, and specifically about the sort of, you know, the what he's the heir apparent to, well, the most likely nominee, who is, of course, Mitt Romney. How does all his tough talk, you know, they're stealing our jobs, we're going to stand up to China, you know, he's going to label them a currency manipulator on day one in the White House, how does that square with his record as a free trader, as somebody who has sort of always supported, you know, has that kind of neoliberal attitude about trade? Is this just that? Is it talk?
Well, if I can answer that from an oblique angle, I think it's interesting looking at how the Chinese state-run media are responding to these sorts of comments, which is to kind of shrug and go, yeah, been there, seen this movie. We'll deal with you if and when you're in office, and you'll do the same thing everyone else did. You'll deal with us, and we'll find a way to do business and move forward.
I mean, I do think that, you know, it's been a surprise to some people in the American sort of political landscape that Romney has come out in the way he has. And I ended up having a conversation with one of the people who's on his foreign policy team. This is, you know, somebody who was sort of interested in his China line. And I said, so where's this coming from? Are you guys sort of feeding him this sort of thing to make him – are you firing him up, telling him that there's a lot of ground there to get? And he said, no, you know, he really came into this campaign with this idea. And frankly, we don't really know where this germinated. But, you know, we've presented our ideas to him. He's listened to them. And actually, he said, thank you very much, but I know what I want to do. And I don't know where that starts. I mean, in some sense, you could make the argument that it's pretty smart politics at the moment, because this is he's more or less, it's a cost-free issue for him. He can get a little mileage out of it. He can get a little bit of sympathy from the voters, and it doesn't cost him anything.
And Clinton thought he knew what he wanted to do too, and he came into office and sent Warren Christopher here, and he had this disastrous visit to China where nothing happened. He was trying to talk human rights. The Chinese were like, yeah, see ya. Tripped on his way out. And after a couple of years, Clinton changed his China policy and became much more pragmatic. I would imagine President Romney would do that too if there ever is a President Romney.
Yeah, they always say that you campaign in poetry and you rule in prose. I mean, this is, you know, it applies to China policy too, I suppose.
I read a piece from the Carnegie Endowment just this afternoon by a guy, I've never really encountered any of his writings before, but somebody named Michael D. Swain, who I think he
oh, he's great.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So he took essentially the position that you were just espousing, that this is good politics, this is smart politics, this really does sort of resonate with the Republican base right now.
And probably also with independents. I mean, if you've got an independent out there who's lost a job, that's a convenient framework in which to have them understand the issue.
No, I think it's staked out a smart position on the economy, basically.
Swain
nice
also
right. Scapegoat position.
Yeah, exactly. He also talks about Santorum and Gingrich, who are maybe – I mean, Santorum's certainly not a serious contender now, but he talks about both of them, just rather dismissive about them, saying that they're really inconsistent and lacking any depth and that they just simply, quote, rely on the political value of painting China as a threat and they lack concrete policy prescriptions, which is actually intended to be in contrast to Romney, who actually sort of has things that he says he wants to do and seems a little better informed. I mean, Santorum in particular talks about, you know, godless socialism and describes China as a, quote, thief of U.S. manufacturing jobs and a scapegoat for it.
I mean, Santorum is essentially something like an American version of Professor Kong Qingdong.
Santorum is also a descendant of Confucius.
Yeah. Little known fact.
I mean, how can you take seriously somebody who, when you Google him, you get those
Dan
results?
Dan Savage.
I mean, I'm sorry, this is not a serious person.
let's hope you're right. And that we're not.
Well, and also, don't forget Gingrich's very serious and specific moon plan.
Oh, right.
Which is for us, for the United States to get to the moon before China, which I thought the U.S. had already done.
And set up a colony.
Oh, and set up a colony.
And Romney said, and if one of my employees suggested that, I'd fire him.
Well, he likes to fire people.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, he does, right. Which is funny for a guy who's always talking about creating jobs. Now, Paul Krugman actually described Newt Gingrich as a dumb person's idea of what a smart person sounds like, and I've just never heard a more apt description.
Well, that could
in my
be
life.
very potent in a U.S. election campaign.
So we talked a little bit about how Beijing's reacting to all of this. Orville Schell, who's, you know, of course, a veteran China watcher, who now heads up the U.S. China Center at the Asia Society, He was quoted in Politico thusly. He said, initially, the Chinese were very offended by these statements, but over the last few years, they've acquired a more sophisticated knowledge about the almost craziness that comes over a country during the campaign. They're beginning to understand they should not react to everything. Things usually settle down afterwards. I mean, it's just as Mary Kay suggested. But, you know, he puts this, the time frame is just in the last few years. I mean, my sense is that really since 96, this is they've already stopped.
I think Chairman Mao understood this, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did.
I think it goes back a long, long time. Right.
I mean,
I think Mao said he preferred dealing with Republicans because they were more stable.
Which was my next question, right? I mean, is there still, do you think, a CCP preference for the GOP?
I think for what the GOP was. I don't know if they know how to deal with people like Rick Santorum.
Yeah, they haven't fully grappled with the issue of evangelical politics. I mean, there are all these elements that have just sort of been injected into the Republican equation that I don't think China has fully processed yet. But
not just China, the world. I mean, if you're a Saudi Arabian, how do you deal with the new style of republicanism?
Well, actually, jihadism. I mean, and sort of Wahhabism. In
they're
that
used
sense,
to it.
Does have a kind of sympathy. I mean,
new nonetheless, right? It's. I mean, everybody has to learn to deal with this, including Americans. You know, what do you do with the Republican Party now? They're no longer the one you used to love or hate.
I think that from a Chinese perspective, it wasn't really the Republicans that confused them last time around. It was the Democrats, because the Chinese had become completely convinced that Hillary was clearly going to be the nominee because she had all of the obvious qualifications. She had all of the connections, all of the guanxi you needed to become the nominee. And then you had this man, this African-American man, who had none of the right background.
He went to Harvard, though.
He did, and they put that high up.
Only for law school.
Right? They always put that high up in the sort of, you know, descriptions. But then it just was completely baffling that it sort of prevailed. And I don't think people really haven't even fully processed it yet when you sort of look at Chinese political analysis of that race.
Now, China played a very different role in the recent State of the Union than it did when it was mentioned in previous State of the Union addresses, where I think it was just a couple of years ago that it was still sort of this, you know, it was being used to sort of berate America for having slacked off and fallen behind. The tone's changed quite a bit. Gadi, this time President Obama outlined in rather broad brushstrokes his plan to bring American manufacturing jobs back through different tweaks to the tax code mostly, right? I mean, is there any chance of this actually materializing? Oh, yeah, he has this new watchdog trade cop thing, trade enforcement.
I can't imagine it'll have huge impact. I think, you know, he threw in some stuff, some bones in the State of the Union speech, but I can't imagine how you can, with those kind of tweaks, make a major shift in, you know, global economic forces that have sent a lot of manufacturing jobs, not just to China, but to, you know, the rest of Asia, to Latin America. It's much more complicated than just, you know, a couple tweaks to the tax code and a watchdog group.
It depends on what kind of jobs, what kind of manufacturing jobs. When you're talking very high-end, very skilled jobs, there are jobs that can stay in the States. When you're talking low-end, where people in China or Bangladesh or Cambodia are working for $150 a month, those jobs aren't coming back. But I think one of the points he made that resonated with people who care about this kind of thing is, you know, why should companies be getting a tax break to send the jobs overseas? We should be giving them tax breaks to keep the jobs here. And there almost seemed to be a sort of a pep talk quality to what he was saying. You know, look, why is China doing so well on things like renewable energy when we're the innovative ones, when we're the ones who could be doing this here? We should be putting our energy into this.
You know, it is worth pointing out that, you know, he made reference to Steve Jobs, and it was a complimentary reference, of course. And also in the Republican response to the State of the Union, Mitch Daniels referred to Steve Jobs basically saying, we wish we could have more of these kinds of stories in America.
Created a million jobs at Foxconn.
Exactly. If you look at the Twitter reaction, it was everybody saying, but hold on a second. Isn't actually that not the model we want to follow?
It was interesting because it was so close to the time that big New York Times piece, you know, the David Barbosa piece came out, which was, you know, a very well-reported piece, but it left out one very, very crucial, you know, angle on this, which is, look, I mean, Apple does not hold all the cards in this. There are, you know, a handful of companies in this big wide world of ours that are remotely capable of doing, you know, of delivering the kinds of products that we're used to at the kinds of prices we're accustomed to.
And what was left slightly unspoken was the kind of responsiveness that they praised, you know, the Chinese, you know, logistics for, you know.
This is exactly it, right?
Well, comes at the expense of workers.
That they can hire, you know, 3,000 workers overnight or work, you know, extra hours immediately. That's because of, you know, financial flexibility by being able to pay your workers very little and have them housed in dorms, hundreds of thousands of workers in ways that just wouldn't be replicable
and
in the U.S.
Working in factories that blow up. I mean, you know, one thing Apple could do, obviously, and other companies like it, is allow a little bit more of a profit margin so that the companies, the subcontractors, don't feel they are so squeezed that they have to do things like this. And then also have really strong sanctions if you don't follow the rules for worker safety. One of the people quoted in David Barbosa's story said, you know, who was an Apple official employee, said, you know, these companies would do this overnight if Apple insisted they had to.
What was that piece called? Mr. Barbosa Goes to the Apple Factory?
No, I think I would point out it was also Charles Duhigg was involved in that story, and a very, very good reporter at the Times, too, who was the co-byline on that
piece. Oh, right.
You know, one thing – also, I do want to mention about the State of the Union, sort of the tone. I agree with Gotti. I think over the long term, basically, this will sort of wash out over the campaign because nobody ends up voting in a presidential campaign based on China policy. But I think what I noticed, at least in the – my sense from Obama's comments – was that something had shifted between the last State of the Union and this State of the Union. In the last State of the Union, he was talking about China in a sort of vaguely inspirational tone, saying, look, you know, this is the competitive guy across the street. Let's remember who we are as Americans and let's really go out and distinguish ourselves. China now has the world's fastest supercomputer, but that should be us. And he was sort of invoking the, you know, the Sputnik moment, that moment in American life where we were sort of challenged by the Soviets to get up and do better and succeeded in surpassing them. This time around, it was sort of more like saying, well, you know, they just put Sputnik in space, but Sputnik is a ripoff of something that we've had in production and we should go after them. And it was sort of there was a more aggressive response that I think if he's expressing it on that side of the aisle, I think that has shifted more into the mainstream of American political thought than it was before.
I want to clarify. I do think that there is more political payoff now than ever for using China as a prop in a presidential election campaign.
Yeah, but
this year there is a little bit of payoff because of the, you know, the economic implications. You know?
I see. Right.
It's still not going to become, I mean,
what
the
I'm
thing
talking,
in your mind
I'm,
as you enter the
right. I mean, there'll be some payoff. What I was just talking about is that in terms of policy, pragmatically, I don't expect huge shifts. But I do think that the rhetoric will have a little bit more it will resonate more. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So all of this is, of course, taking place against the backdrop of what I think we'd all agree is a pretty significant foreign policy reorientation. I think in the November jaunt that President Obama took around the Pacific, you know, Hawaii for the APEC meeting, so his home state, and then to a place where he spent some time in his childhood in Indonesia. And to, of course, Australia, where he, you know, dropped the biggest bomb for those of us who were sitting here, he really raised hackles, right, with the administration's promise to install what was the number, 2,400 or so Marines in northern Australia. Mm-hmm. What does this all look like from Beijing's perspective? I mean, is it inaccurate for them to think that this is something nothing short of containment?
It's totally directed at China.
Of course.
I think that's pretty obvious. I mean, of course, the U.S. is not going to say so. But I think people who run in those circles, they're confident that that is exactly the motivation behind it. And so Beijing is absolutely correct to view this as directed at them.
I mean, there are other things, too. I mean, the warming with the junta in Burma, of course, a
Trans-Pacific partnership.
Exactly.
I mean, the sort of staking out a new Asian community that includes the United States, but doesn't seem to include China. I mean, these are, and I think there are people on the American side that are starting to talk about this. I mean, the official line is, of course, no, you know, this is not directed at China. But you don't have to go very far into the conversation before
correct.
People say this is directed at China, and they want China to hear that, partly because, you know, it's sort of reached that point in the administration now where, you know, 3 years in, and I think that the initial sort of tolerance for we can all get along is usually exhausted by this point.
Right. You don't have to go very deep on background to get that analysis.
And it's both sort of a catching up because the U.S. had their eye off the ball in terms of mm-hmm. Asia during the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and up until when Obama became president and the policy shifted slightly. But also it's saying, you know, look, we have been in Asia, an Asian presence for decades. We don't intend to go away quietly. I know you think that you're rising and you're strong and we're falling and we're weak and you'd like to just kick us aside and get on with it. That's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I the Chinese did predict this, by the way. I remember when the surge started to work in Iraq, there was almost like an audible sigh from Chinese foreign policy analysts where they said, oh, no, now the United States is going to be freed up to come and turn its attention towards us. And they were basically right. You know.
When we talk about voters not really being impacted by China policy, it's not going to be, you know, weighing heavily on their minds. We talk about it with a sort of dismissive attitude. But part of me says that they ought to really concern themselves with how well the commander-in-chief understands the dimensions of this very, very important bilateral relationship. I mean, they really ought to. How important do you think? I mean, do you think it shouldn't be something that a viable candidate or a good candidate should be able to articulate, like a coherent policy toward, you know, this incredibly important part of the world? I mean, shouldn't they have a handle on this important bilateral relationship? I mean, I just cannot see anyone in the GOP field measuring up to President Obama on this.
Well, you heard what Fidel Castro had to say.
No.
Which was what?
He said that this was an incredibly stupid field of candidates.
And this,
I don't think that's going to hurt any of their, you know, chances.
And the amazing thing about that is that Fidel Castro has been dead
for
months.
That was nice to see. He still has a little life in him.
Jeremy, what does it look like as a non-American? I mean, are you just sort of chuckling or are you
in
despair?
Well, I think like a lot of Americans, a lot of foreigners look at this at the moment and throw up their hands in exasperation. It seems that the, you know, what should be the world's preeminent democracy is kind of confused. You know, it's not just the China policy, it's everything. I mean, you know, what the hell is going on? Democrats can't get their act together. They got their guy in and then they all started hating him. And the Republicans appear to have all drunk some kind of Kool-Aid.
Okay.
I would say, though, that it looks like Mitt Romney is going to emerge on the Republican side, and he's relatively close to what the Republicans generally produce in a campaign. So,
I mean, and also the cannibalism is not specific to the Democrats. I mean, it's kind of amazing watching the way the Republicans have torn each other to shreds.
And
the Democrats, I mean, sitting in Chicago, these guys are just, I'm sure their jaws have dropped and they're just in amazement at all the hard work the Republicans are doing to help them in the general election.
Well, it's reminiscent of the Democrats in the 80s.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the most
reliable
tropes.
For those of us slightly old enough to remember that.
Well, okay, let's move on.
I was told by my grandparents.
and do our recommendations for the week. Gadi, you got something for us to start off with?
Yes, the book I'm reading right now is Super Sad True Love Story, which, of course, is, I think, an old hat to many people. But I just got it this summer, and then I'm finishing it up now. I'm a very slow reader. No, I just dived back into it after having put it aside. And it has a big China angle to it.
Right.
China's central banker is basically the most powerful person in the world. It's a near future novel where the U.S. is in complete shambles and they are using UN-pegged dollars in their economy. And the president is going to the airport to greet China's central banker, who he obviously owes all his money to. It's basically today.
Well, it's sort of a paranoid, authoritarian, youth-obsessed state where everyone shares everything about themselves on their apparatus,
right.
on their
so in other words,
basically
it's,
smartphones.
Right. I mean,
Facebook.
It was basically it's basically what we have now, but just it was mildly prescient when it came out. So,
which was only a year ago, right?
Yeah, and it's very amusing. So,
why are you reading that?
I'm reading that because, the author, Gary Steingart, will be here in Beijing.
Yes, he will.
For the Bookworm Festival. I'll be talking to him on stage at the opening night of the Bookworm Festival.
And so, as long as we're on the Steingart kick, I would add just that Absurdistan, another book of his, it has a lot of resonance these days with China because there's all these – he's describing post-Soviet Russia, but if you start looking at princelings driving Ferraris and the kind of weird lawlessness that seems to prevail at certain moments in Beijing, there's a lot of it that rings true. So I can also put it
now, had Gary Steingart spent any time in China? I mean, I know he does a lot of travel writing, but does anyone? You're his colleague at The New Yorker, or he writes for The New Yorker from time to time.
Yeah, I have no idea if he's been to China, actually.
Okay. I'm wondering if we're in for another David Sedaris surprise. Or...
Well, I've only just begun an email exchange with him in advance of the book. I'll have to ask him about that. Back when we were emailing and introduced, Kim Jong-il had just died or just been announced. I told him I was busy with that, but if he had a quote for me for The Economist, you know, please feel offer him one up. And he wrote right back, he loved to dance. No one ever talks about that.
That's great. Have you guys heard about – I mean, it was just actually reviewed in The New Yorker, this book by – I'm sorry. His surname is Johnson. He's an American writer, a piece of fiction set in North Korea. You guys see this review yet? Oh, anyway, yeah. I'm spacing the title of the book. Anyway, that's not
what,
my
the Orphan's book?
It's about this guy who, you know, toils. I mean, he's trained as like a total pitch black tunnel fighter in North Korea. He eventually sort of reinvents himself and emerges as a sort of minorly powerful general who's locked in a power struggle with Kim Jong-il.
Well, no, but while we're on Book Association, I'd take that opportunity to recommend James Church's Inspector O books.
We're just going off on weird tangents here.
if you have a North Korea fetish.
So, Evan, you may not know this, but we do this little recommendations thing that I've stolen shamelessly from the Slate Culture podcast. And at the end of each hour, it's something sort of China-related. You got something for us?
Yeah. I mean, I actually recently read the Fat Years in English translation now, which is just now out in the United States. And you know, it's actually a similar conceit as Super Sad True Love Story. It's just over the horizon and actually turns out to be the present. And
all of Beijing has been doped, right? Or all of China has
been,
right?
All of China has been doped. And the one part of it that, I mean, the, you know.
Into believing that everything is perfect.
Yeah, everybody basically has been given a drug and they've forgotten a month of their lives. That's the conceit. I'm not
giving
anything
away. Let's just do that for Hong Kong.
After the month, China is now the prosperous.
Right. They've forgotten a month of horrible, horrible turmoil.
And the one thing that's worth mentioning is that one of the sort of solutions to that conceit in the plot is that, well, why didn't the leaders get doped as well? The answer is that because they have their own water supply, so they're not drinking the same water as everybody else. And I read that and had to smile because recently we've learned that the leaders, in fact, do have their own
air filter system, their own farms.
Right. And so it's just amazing.
With an air filter company marketing itself as used in Zhongnanhai, the leadership compound.
Okay, great. Mary Kay, what you got for us?
Yeah, so I'm recommending Consent of the Networked by Rebecca McKinnon. This is a book that's just come out. Rebecca is a former colleague of ours. She used to be here for CNN, and in fact, she grew up in China. So when she first thought about writing a book about the internet, she had gotten involved in creating this wonderful website called Global Voices, which brings together blogs from all over the world, translates them into English, so journalists and others who are just interested in hearing what people are writing and thinking about can go to it, and they're also potentially a resource. When she thought about moving from that to writing a book about the internet, initially she thought about China and how the internet's affecting China and how the government is trying to control the internet. She quickly expanded it to look at the state of the internet today and the conflict between people who would like the internet to be free, to be a conduit for civil society, for exchange of information, and governments and others who would like to limit that and control it, and what people need to do to push back and keep it open.
Her theme basically is that governments are actually a whole lot more savvy and resilient, they're quite smart about the way that they've used the internet.
I mean, right. And she's not just talking about authoritarian governments. She's also talking about the U.S. government. She's talking about regulations that sort of get slipped in when people aren't looking, and that you need to look. You need to be aware of what's being considered and how that's going to affect your ability to have free use online.
Yeah, I mean, she certainly has every possible credential. I mean, to have written this. I mean, there's nobody better qualified to have written this book. And she is one of the world's leading thinkers on problems of technology.
Really, and it's tightly written and a really good read.
Yeah, she's a great writer. And Jeremy, what do you have for us this week?
I have, if I may be forgiven, two recommendations. The first one is the new issue of ChinaHeritageQuarterly.org is out. And this one is about the West Lake, Hangzhou's West Lake, which there's a marvelous range of essays and reporting and writings and photographs on this place in China, which, if I may quote from the introduction, where a particular culture of refined indulgence developed around temples, pleasure boats, tea houses, eating places, courtesans' quarters, and wine shops. Hangzhou, the West Lake, kind of a paradise China. And then away from paradise China to the horrible things Chinese intellectuals say to each other, my Danway colleague Joel Martinson
just to save the rest of us the trouble, wrote up a post on Dunway.com about the fight that's been brewing between the bad boy novelist rally car driver Hahan and the so-called fraud-busting science cop Feng Zhouzhou, who's been accusing Hahan of using a team of ghostwriters to produce his works. And this is one of these strange feuds that erupt between Chinese intellectuals that can be quite impenetrable to the outsider. And this particular one occurred during the Spring Festival Chinese New Year holiday when there were a lot of Chinese people with too much time on their hands in front of their computers, hating their in-laws or their parents and wanting to get away. And so it's generated a lot of discussion.
What are your early conclusions, Jeremy, based about what Feng Zhouzhou is saying about Han Han?
真他妈无聊.
Really fucking boring.
Yeah. But
it's a serious accusation.
No, I mean, so Mai Tian, who was initially part of this pogrom, actually kicked it off, right? I mean, he's a former colleague of mine at Baidu.
He started off, yeah.
Right. He's already eaten crow. He's already sort of said, oh, I was wrong. I mean, he's completely backed off on this, and he's issued a formal apology to Han Han. But, Feng Zhouzhou is a pit bull. I mean, he's got his teeth sunk deeply into the ankles here, and he's not going to let go. So it's going to be a fun diversion if we don't want to watch Hong Kong, and China at virtual war with one another.
You mean Hong Kong and the mainland. They're both China, of course.
Right. I'm sorry. Now I'm going to get asked to tea. Okay. So my recommendations, first of all, I mean, one's nearly a year old, but it's Patrick Chovanich, who's an oft-quoted China watcher who teaches at Tsinghua. He wrote an excellent primer. I don't know if you guys have seen this before, on China's forthcoming leadership transition. I said it's like 9 months old now, but it is not at all out of date. It's very much worth reading. It's an ideal thing for the layman. His blog is at chovanich.wordpress.com, and just do a search on there for a primer. My second recommendation is Leslie T. Chang's, Zhang's piece in The New Yorker. It's titled Working Titles, What Do the Most Industrious People in the World Read for Fun? It's all about workplace novels and novels of officialdom. She looks at the sort of promotion diaries, like Dulala's promotion diary.
Is she the new China correspondent for New Yorker? I've been looking forward to seeing different yes. voices, someone better.
Yes, it's good. I'm glad to see also The Economist finally just bring people in for trial runs, let them move on to new things.
Keep this going. This is fun. Anyway, it's really funny because it turns out that the most industrious people in the world, what they read for fun is these books about the workplace, right? About how to get ahead in the workplace. And I mean, there's this sort of theme of amorality that runs through the whole thing. I mean, there are actually, how the poorest guy in the world got rich, which contains these bold points on like how to be an amoral dickwad and get ahead.
Although, I mean, America's not that different. I mean, if you think of one of the most popular similar books in the United States is that appalling book by Tim Ferriss, The 4-Hour Workweek, which, I mean, the essential moral position is that, working is for suckers. What you should do is, find some, product that you can con people into buying online for and then hire a virtual assistant in the Philippines. Then you only have to work 4 hours a week and you get rich.
I think he's taking advantage of a fertile existing market.
Right. Possibly.
God, you've been on the 4-Hour Workweek for years.
This is weird because, it's the contemporary Chinese answer to the Horatio Alger novel, except that these are completely amoral. I mean, there's sort of no thread of – anyway. Unfortunately, this is behind a paywall, so you can just write to Evan and he'll send you the
Fortunately, it's behind
most of us support paywalls paying
but
for your
for those
content.
Of you who are like me, audible.com subscribers, and this podcast this week, no, it's not brought to you by audible.com, but it's on the Audible version of The New Yorker for this week, and if you can make it through the mangled butchering of Chinese words, Dulala, for example, anyway, it's quite good. So, that's all for this week. Gadi, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Evan, great to see you. Mary Kay, good
Thanks.
To see you. And Jeremy, of course. And we will see you next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care.